Lest Thou First counts too. Yes, whatever.
Yeah. Welcome, Tom Telpy from Microsoft. He's the man to give us the most headaches in this conference because he tells us how much we fall behind Microsoft's SAP implementation.
Maybe not so much this time. We'll see. Yeah.
Welcome.
Thank you, Volker. Hi, everybody. I'm Tom Telpy, Microsoft. Again, I'm sorry for screwing up the order of the morning, but I think I've got that out of the way. My responsibilities out of the way. This time around, I've come to speak at many Samba XPs before. I'm always happy to be here, always happy to bring the message. The message has changed over the years, right? Our partnership has grown and our tasks have changed quite a bit. So we have a very different engagement today and going forward. And I think that's true of Microsoft as well. I'm not really a member of the SMB team right now, right? I'm here and speaking for Microsoft, but a number of reorganizations within Microsoft have occurred. And so most of us are doing very different things. Many of the people that you might know from the SMB team are still involved in SMB, but are either working on other projects in the company or focused on other things. And I think that's important to realize. You know, it's just a personal, purely personal note. It really doesn't impact the business of SMB at all. But the hallmark of our relationship has been that sort of one-to-one developer-to-developer kind of discussion. And it's changing. The developers have moved, you know, or have other things on their mind. So I, in particular, and part of the networking team at Microsoft now, the so-called, it used to be called Windows Devices Group, Stack. It's now basically part of Microsoft Azure. I've been reorged into the Azure organization. I still work on Windows. I still work on networking. I still work on SMB3. I still work on all those other things. Just a little flavor. I'm in a very different part of the company than I was just a few months ago. And So I'm in this presentation, I'm going to speak for myself a little bit, for Microsoft a little bit, more me than Microsoft. And I'm going to point at other people or other discussions that are going on and other places you might want to look. In particular, the two upcoming events are one in June, our annual Redmond Interop event that I hope many of you are planning to come to, and also the Storage Developer Conference in September. These are sort of the rhythms of our interop, of our publicly facing SMB protocol efforts for, you know, the broad industry, not just for Samba, for instance, as we do here. And so I'm going to point you to those for the official word, if you will, from a lot of these individuals. I'll give you the unofficial word and a little peek. So anyway, that's enough waffling. Let me talk about some things that I'm here for. I just want to take a quick look at SMB3 today and look at the things that are in the works for Windows, right? That's basically what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to touch on the SMB1 situation. I have a little bit of news there, but you know, I think it's important. We've come a long way. I gave a presentation last year that was about Microsoft Samba collaboration. And SMB1 was one of those things, and I'm happy to say we've made a lot of progress there on the collaboration in general. And then other uses of SMB3, this is kind of my pet thing, RDMA, protocols, push mode, et cetera, things like that. SMB3 today is the key storage protocol for Windows interoperability. It exports the Win32 file API over the network. That's what everybody thinks SMB3 is, right? That it's somehow, that's, you know, remote files, right? But SMB3 is actually a lot more than that. It's extensible to other semantics and to multiple transports. And that really is what's been important about SMB3 in the past few years. You know, it's a session protocol. There aren't many session protocols in the industry today, right? You log in, you authenticate, you establish a session that can have multiple connections. You have multiple protocols flowing over those connections. Multiple users share them. It's a key to many other things. To transporting many other things. It's a mature protocol. It's really important. It's been shipping basically since 2006, technically, as SMB2. SMB3 itself shipped in 2012, Windows Server 2012. You know, we started previewing it in basically 2010. But it's quite mature. The features that it has are very well tested, very well documented, very well implemented by the broad third party. It's a really solid, stable platform. So I think that's important. And it runs on many diverse operating system platforms. And I'll just mention Microsoft and Samba here, but you know, we have dozens of vendors in our SMB3 interop space. It's a very, very broad space. You know, we've seen many come and a few go. There's a constant change in this space of companies stepping up to support SMB3. The large reason why most companies, not necessarily Samba, but most companies support SMB3 is that stuff at the beginning. It's key to Windows interop. It's especially key to the first thing here, Hyper-V. Hyper-V uses SMB for its storage transport, basically. That's how Hyper-V gets remote access to VHDs. That's how it migrates. That's all these important deployment enterprise features of Hyper-V that are exposed by SMB. It shares the same authentication subsystem, right? So you can authenticate and you know, Active Directory, that sort of membership is important to Hyper-V deployments, et cetera. It's also used sort of under the covers. There's this thing called Storage Spaces Direct in Windows. I've talked about it before. We don't talk about it much here because it's kind of an internal Windows thing. Storage Spaces is Windows software RAID, right? It allows for collections of storage devices to form something called a storage pool, which is very abstract. It's not just a partition or a device. It's literally a hunk of the storage volume that can be added to the pool. And then Spaces manages it as a redundant array of drives. You know, it can do parity, it can do replication, mirroring. It supports snapshotting. It doesn't implement snapshotting, but some of its features are important for that. It can bring together pools of diverse devices, like you can have SSDs and HDDs. You can now have persistent memory as part of a storage space. And so all these things, Storage Spaces Direct uses SMB3 as its transport. Windows Clustering also uses it internally for the Cluster Shared Volume protocol. That's a sort of a single image file system across the cluster. So where are we going with SMB3? You've seen SMB 3.1.1 for several years. We're not changing a thing about it. But this is roughly a list of all the things we're thinking about and in the process of implementing, whether or not these become features of the Windows operating system or of the protocol itself. Only a couple of these actually impact the protocol. I'll mention these as I go. But whether they become that is not for me to say. But I am allowed to more or less tell you a little bit about where we're interested and what we're thinking about. And my goal in doing this is to see if the Samba project has an interest in any of these, and if there are things that we can work together on and work to improve. And there's a couple more that aren't on this list that you'll remember in a minute, but I'm leaving those to some other people. So I'm just going to run down these. The push mode I'm going to talk about at the end. All the other ones I'm going to run down in the next few slides. So signing. We talked about this at SDC, I think, 2 years ago, 1 year ago, some time ago. I think it was 2 years ago, actually. We had a an intern named Aaron Friedlander who did this work. It was called GHASH at the time. It's basically Galois message authentication. It's called GMAC. GMAC is computationally extremely efficient. It's like, I forget, 40,000 times more efficient than computing some of these other hashes. It's an extremely efficient software algorithm. SMB3 uses AES CMAC today, a couple different modes, right? They are a little heavier weight computationally. GMAC is much, much lighter weight. And we discussed it at a prior SDC. We showed it. I'm here to say today that we're considering its support in Windows. Making it official. Basically, there's a bit in the negotiate context that says what encryption and signing formats you use, and this would basically just be a new option that would appear in that list, and we would expect clients and servers to select it because of its computational efficiency. All right? SMB3 over QUIC. This one's kind of big and kind of interesting, but it's definitely a future-looking thing. QUIC is a lightweight new transport that operates over UDP. It was developed originally by Google. It's now an IETF open standard. Still being developed. It's still quite a bit of a moving target. But its primary features are that it has connection and congestion efficiency. It has a very lightweight connection model. With UDP, it doesn't require a three-way handshake. And the QUIC protocol allows servers and clients, or two peers, to basically remember that they've connected to each other in the past. And they can go through a heavyweight connection once, and then go through this very lightweight, literally zero trip. It's just sending, saying, you know, I've talked to you before, and the ID was ABC, and I prove I'm who I am, and why don't we just pick up where we left off? Literally. It's incredibly useful for HTTP servers, right? You take that three-way handshake and TLS handshake right out of the picture. It has the security, by the way, as well. It integrates a TLS-like feature. And the second interesting thing about QUIC is that it was implemented in user space on top of UDP in the Google browser originally. And the idea was that it would be very lightweight experimentation platform. And so congestion is a big deal in the internet, I'm sure you've heard, and it's especially a big deal for web services and things. So congestion got a lot of attention in QUIC, and there are a lot of very effective congestion algorithms for QUIC that have emerged out of it. It's a QUIC development process as well as a QUIC protocol, right? We're considering it for SMB3. We actually could use the connection model, but in particular, we could use the lightweight transport and congestion control in SMB quite effectively. And Matthew George is going to talk about this at SDC, so I'm really not going to say any more. I'm going to leave it all to him. But look for this talk at SDC and think about it. We already support TCP and RDMA. We support NetBIOS, although we try not to anymore. Adding another transport is really not that big a stretch. SMB is very transport agnostic. Expects a server with an IP address and some sort of protocol that it can try to use. So, NetBIOS technically doesn't have an IP address, but it has a mapping, right? So, think about that. Compression. The transform header in SMB3 is used for encryption today. But when it was first thought up, it actually had two flavors. It had an encryption flavor and it had a compression flavor. By the protocol ID field is pretty much what names the transform header. That first 4 bytes is a field. And today we use FDOG SMB. That means it's an encryption and it has a defined payload for encryption with a nonce and a session ID and stuff like that that give the tokens needed for the receiver to interpret the rest of the message, right? The transform header wraps an SMB3 message. Well, Other transforms are possible, and the one we're thinking about is in particular compression. And I'm not going to talk about the details of what we're doing, because that, once again, that's Matthew's responsibility and area. But I'll tell you what it's interesting for. It's interesting for both local and remote. You might think it was interesting for remote, but we use SMB3 locally. Remember, I just mentioned Hyper-V uses it. Well, disk drives have big chunks of redundant data in it, you know, and that compression is a very useful transform to avoid that. It's especially like for Hyper-V live migration, where you're going to transfer large chunks of basically zero pages or boring, uninteresting pages. Hyper-V has a protocol to leave those out, but SMB could also participate in this, right? And so we're thinking about compression and here. Now, this one would be protocol visible. You could see that it would change the transform header. So we don't have anything specific to talk about today, but you can basically imagine what will happen. Sure, Jeremy.
So would you be able to nest transforms? Would you be able to have, say, internal compression followed by encryption on top?
Yes, or? Absolutely. Client-driven write-through. This is an important one. It's not a protocol change. It's a behavior change. And it's a behavior change that we're going to take more and more advantage of. We already define in SMB 3.1.1 this per-operation write-through. Right, there's this flag in the SMB 2 write operation. And we define this flag as of SMB 3.1.1. It used to be that you could open a file in a specific mode. But it turns out that things like Hyper-V and file systems don't want to do all their writes in that mode. They want to toggle between that mode, right? They might have bulk data and they might have metadata, and the metadata is really important and needs to get to the disk. The bulk data, well, we can schedule that. And so these upper layers that consume SMB, Hyper-V and file systems in particular, use this flag or want to use this flag. And they don't usually, we don't usually run file systems over SMB, right? We usually run SMB over file systems, right? We do an SMB connection to a server who accesses the file system. But increasingly, we're turning that picture around, and Hyper-V is using SMB3 as a transport for its actual file system traffic. It's doing blocks over SMB, in effect. And so this becomes really useful to the block mode workloads. And so servers will see more and more of this as time goes on. So I'm showing this one pretty much as a bit of good news. We've already got the protocol. It's just like, this is a flag that you're going to see this happen more, and it's going to mean something. So, you know, pay attention to the messages. It's more than just supporting the messages. It's supporting the semantics that the application wants. Move on connect. Once again, we already have this. In SMB 3.1.1, we define this tree connect context, much like the negotiate context. When the client connects to the server, it is able to exchange a context with the server that tells it something about the context in which it's connecting to this server resource. And one of the responses of this context is this new extended error defined in SMB 3.1.1 that allows redirects recent clients? That's the wrong word. I'm not sure what that means. Redirects clients to the optimal server. So the idea being that in a clustered scenario, the client may want to connect to a particular share, and that share might be hosted on just one node in the cluster. So, but he connects to cluster node Q, or he gets DNS round robin to cluster node Q. Q says, well, you better talk to P because he's the one who owns that file system. Q can forward things to P, but Q would much prefer to tell the client to go to P. And we used to have the witness protocol to do this, but the witness protocol is A, another protocol, B, a little bit clunky, honestly. It works quite well, especially for manual rebalancing, but it's, you know, a second RPC connection and a lot of additional work on a second protocol. So what's happening is that our Windows scale-out file servers begin to use this. And so scale-out file servers are a special case of the Windows file server. And so you'll see Windows actually replying with this Tree Connect context. Used to be it was defined in the protocol, and the clients were ready to do it, but nothing was actually sending it. Now, and this is coming up in Server 2019, which will ship in 2018, but it's called 2019. And you'll see this happen more and more. So you can think of it like a forwarding. And, you know, servers could use this for other things. But remember that not all clients support it. Anything prior to 2016-ish probably won't send this context and therefore won't process it.
One question to the last slide.
Yeah.
We could utilize something like that on a per-file basis even.
The protocol doesn't define a per-file redirection. It happens only at Tree Connect time, prior to any I.O. On per-file basis, it starts to get really hairy, because if the client starts to interleave operations to a redirected server and a non-redirected server, which then forwards them, operations are going to appear out of order, and very interesting things may happen that applications may need to be ready for. I think it would be dangerous to do this on a per-file basis without application awareness. That's just an initial response. But in any event, it's not supported by the protocol right now. You could return a DFS, you know, redirect when you try to open the file. That's done on a per-file basis. Okay. Identity tunneling and global mount. I put these together because they're related, although they're not at all the same. So this was discussed a couple of years ago at SDC. Identity tunneling allows a system identity for authorized access. The idea being that when the client is tree connecting to a resource, that it wants to present a set of credentials for the Tree Connect, much like a Unix mount, basically, that will be used for all operations on that tree connection. And it's very useful for Hyper-V scenarios where the trust is already established, you know, where we have a host partition speaking to guest partitions that are already trusted. We're doing everything on behalf of a single consumer, a single principal, basically. But that principal happens to have a set of identities within it that it's already managing, right? So, for instance, Unix will present a set of server-based credentials to open a VHD, but then will proceed to do all the VHD operations under its own policies, that type of thing. And so the identity tunneling provided a credential at Tree Connect time that was then used for all the further operations. It would simply replace whatever credentials came with the operation with the cached credentials. Global mount is kind of related to that, but it's very different. So we have these so-called persistent shares for years and decades in DOS and Windows, where the client, when it booted up, would connect to a share and would give it a map it to a drive letter and allow that thing to be used all the time. Now, that wasn't identity tunneled. That was just kind of a connection, right, to the share that would allow each individual process to access, if it were allowed, the things on that share. But global mount is really clunky, right? It's a drive letter. It's a volume level thing. What we really wanted was to have the SMB2 style mount, Tree Connect, to be allowed to be made to be global. And so with some PowerShell plumbing basically wrapped around things we already had in part identity tunneling, we can implement global mount. Global mount is really useful in modern Windows for container-based scenarios, where, you know, these container will literally come into being for a moment, do some work for a short period of time, and then go away. It's always coming and going. We don't want to actually have to go out and mount all the resources and create all these things. We cache them and keep them lying around in the container. framework. And so Global Mount maps really well to containers. It makes them much more efficient. And it also takes a whole lot of administration pain and suffering out of the way. So you see both of these implemented and used in additional ways by future Windows clients. So particularly that identity tunneling is going to be important. If you don't support it well, you'll need to support it well in the future. Yes.
For the identity tunneling, do you have some materials somewhere available? I sort of missed this.
Yeah, it was the subject of a storage developer conference in 2 years ago,
two
I think.
Years ago.
There was some discussion of it at last year's as well, I think. I'll have to go back and look. It's in the protocol document. There is a bunch of stuff on MSDN about configuring it in Windows and using it.
So
basically,
tunneling already implemented, right?
Already in
Windows.
In Windows, yes.
Okay.
Already deployed in Windows. It's just say additional use.
Mm-hmm.
I said implementation. What I really mean is that further implementation. Yeah. It's basically a net use command, a special net use command where you specify the credentials. So that's a look at some of the things that are happening in Windows. Not so much in the protocol, mostly in Windows. There are a couple of other things, and I'm going to talk about them based on last year's Samba XP, but I'm going to leave the details to my colleagues who are going to talk about them. And basically, one is SMB Direct. SMB Direct, of course, is the RDMA mapping for SMB, and we have been contributing to an SMB Direct implementation on Linux. Long Lee is here, and we'll be talking about it. So I say review. This is almost exactly the slide that I presented last year. But, you know, these facts are still true. We're doing a client. We're not contemplating doing a server implementation. Some team's been working on that, but that's not something that Microsoft is currently considering doing. And there are a couple of simplifying initial principles on SMB Direct that are kind of needed because of the state of the SMB client in Linux. One is that connections are made via RDMA directly. It doesn't use the TCP multi-channel discovery, for instance. It just says, well, you told me to do RDMA, I'm going to do RDMA, right? And it automatically reaches out and connects. That was an incredibly strong simplifying principle that is perfectly legal protocol-wise, but it's not done by any other client at this time. A second, basic RDMA transfers only. Initially, the next slide just kind of reviews it, but it would do only inline and wouldn't do RDMA at all. Now it's doing RDMA. What I mean by basic is that it's not doing broadly configurable arcane RDMA transfers. We're not doing push mode, for instance, at this time. So it's a simplified RDMA model. But it does support all the RDMA transports. Now, this is the slide from last year, and I just want to point out the initial implementation connected and transferred data, but it would fail at the time. And it was actually at this event that we discovered why it was failing. It was having a mid error, and that was due to an issue in the SMB Linux SMB client. In which locking was rather awkward around the transport action. And so the MID was allowed to toggle as things were being sent. And that was pretty bad because you'd have holes and repeats in your MID space as a result. So that's actually been fixed. And some things that were not supported at the time was any sort of RDMA read-write. It required memory registration and things like that. And it still doesn't do full multi-channel. This year, it's very different. It's a full-blown SMB Direct client. It connects via RDMA. It does full RDMA, both inline and direct transfer. And Long is currently reviewing patches for doing a direct I/O straight out of user buffers uncached, right? That's what the NFS RDMA client does right now, and it's working. It's working rather well there. So I would hope for a distinct performance improvement there. Currently, the SMB, the Linux SMB client, copies data in and out of the kernel, right? It's doing everything with so-called bounce buffers, which is all well and good, but completely unnecessary. RDMA is a data mover. That's what it's there for, to avoid that data copy. And so I'm going to leave the discussion of that to Long, but I just want to point out that Microsoft has been doing this work, and we're very excited about it. Second thing is Unix, otherwise known as POSIX extensions. Last year, I called them the key to Linux SMB3 support, right? And long overdue, we've been talking about this forever. Et cetera, et cetera. Let's not rehash last year. This year, there's a Samba server implementation, right? Thank you, Jeremy. Thank you, everybody. It's, there's a prototype, Unix extensions protocol definition. It's actually fairly concise, which I think is great. For a while there, we had a great big, huge, hairy ball of stuff. And huge, hairy balls of stuff are tough for everybody. So I think that's good. There's a Samba client in development, right? The some of these Unix extensions are being implemented in the Samba client, and Steve French is here. Now, you know, I'm not sure if everybody knows this, but Steve French now works for Microsoft. I just want to put that out there as evidence of our commitment to making this work, right? We really want to see Unix extensions work in SMB3. We really want this to be a full peer file protocol for Linux, like it is for Windows. And we envision supporting this stuff in the Azure cloud. So, you know, that's the business reason for us to do it. Linux guests are incredibly important in the Azure cloud. They're all over the Azure cloud. They're the fastest growing guest segment of the Azure cloud. Well, guess what? We want to make them work well, right? And we believe that Unix extensions are the key to that. So once again, I'm going to leave that to my colleague Steve, and you can see more when he talks. All right. Now I'm going to put on my Ned Pyle hat. I told him I'd hold up a Ned Pyle face, but I'm not going to go that far. Ned Pyle is my colleague. He's the program manager for SMB technologies at Microsoft. And he has been waging a campaign called Still Needs SMB1. This is a shorthand URL to Ned Pyle's page. It is Ned's list of all those implementations in the industry that still require SMB1. It was an incredibly long rogues gallery for a while. It has been shrinking. He says with some frustration first, though, that the clearinghouse has been growing, right? We've discovered more and more software and devices identified that depend on SMB1, that either, you know, explicitly connect to SMB1 or which just have terrible oversights that only work on the SMB1 protocol. But the good news is it's been shrinking. The most meaningful shrinkage happened just this month, I think this month meaning May. Ubuntu has stopped defaulting to SMB1 in Bionic, right? And the Ubuntu distribution is obviously a very influential one. And we hope that this will lead to similar decisions by other Linux distributions. Good. Already does. Great to hear it. Red Hat already does. So maybe you should tell Ned. He would give that top billing. Our hope is that the entire Linux ecosystem will follow. So, you know, this is pretty much client side, right? Configuring the server side, but allowing clients to connect to it. Here's the evidence that we have. This is fresh, hot telemetry from Windows. Windows 10, users opt into telemetry, and the telemetry sends a lot of anonymous stuff about the way the system is being used. One of the things in particular is it sends SMB1 telemetry. It counts the uses of SMB1 by clients. It uses this for all kinds of interesting reasons. The most interesting one is that if you install, if you upgrade a system that had SMB1 installed, you upgrade it to one of the recent Windows 10, and you don't use SMB1 for 15 to 30 days, the telemetry discovers this, right? That counter just stays at zero. And it says, he's not using SMB1. Why don't I uninstall it? And that's literally what it does. You can override the uninstall. If you say, I know I'm not using it, but I really want this insecure pile of horse shit, right? And so you say, okay, and we say, all right, you're the boss. But if you haven't told us otherwise, we will bring it into the modern configuration, which is SMB1 is actually uninstalled. Well, these are the ones that in at least professional and enterprise that are still phoning home with the occasional SMB1 connection. And, professional, it's 1.5 million. That's not really a very big number. I mean, we're talking hundreds of millions of installs out there. We're talking a very hopeful trend. And on the right, an even more hopeful trend. The enterprises are throwing this crap out fast as they possibly can. So the writing's on the wall. It's that little red wedge, red slice of pie. It's getting smaller and smaller. I thought I had a number with a little more data. I'll just point out, it's down to basically 23%. A year ago, it was 45% on the left, and 14% from 24%. So roughly a half of those who are using it have switched it off in just 1 year. 1 year. That's really great. You know, it won't take many years of that, half of a half of a half, to get to a very small number. The problem is the servers. The Windows servers are largely switching it off, right? Those connections are counted on both client and server instances from the telemetry. Samba servers, however, the old ones, are still supporting it, especially the 3.x's. And I thought 3.1 also. Okay. Well, maybe if it goes all the way back to 3.0, then great. The problem is they're the ones that are still all over, still needs SMB1. And they're the ones that are still out there and people are still using it. You know, they're either unable or unwilling to upgrade. And some of them, we believe, are vendors who are stuck on the GPL2 code base and are unwilling to move to the GPL3.1, right? So they're stuck with Samba 3 and they're stuck with SMB1 because Samba 2 was only experimental. So that's kind of bad, but we need to unstick this. I'd love to see it outright dropped in a future, SMB1 support outright dropped. But
so it's a little, just to comment on that, it's a little hard for us to remove it. My feeling is that when we move to Samba 5, whenever that will be, maybe not next release, but the release after, that SMB1 should be off by default.
Right. And you have to want it.
Yeah, yep. I don't think... It would be very hard for us to rip out the code and actually prohibit it being used, but I think us shipping off by default for SMB5 would probably have the desired effect. I can't make the 3.0 people upgrade. They have religious reasons or business reasons or
some.
You know, I mean, the fact that Google is using GPLv3 code in Chrome OS ought to, you know, if I can go around and talk to people's lawyers and say, hey, look, this is nothing to be scared of, I do that.
I sympathize with Samba, with you, et cetera, on the difficulty of ripping out code. But I'll tell you, it was difficult for us, and we did it. And
Jeremy just added a test using SMB1 just a few weeks ago.
Volker tells me I'm well under 5 minutes, so I'm going to spend a very limited amount of time here. But Tom's suggestion, annual suggestion...
It's just lunch after you, so...
For future engagement. Windows persistent memory support. I talked about this before. This should be a reminder. But persistent memory is really important new technology. It's coming out on basically all server motherboards. It's coming out from multiple vendors in multiple different forms. Some of them are sort of battery or so-called energy-based DIMMs. Some of them are durable DIMMs in themselves. They're not flash. They use either a phase change or some other type of resistive RAM technology, that type of thing. But those JEDEC-defined NVDIMM devices have been available in Windows for about 2 years now. And they're supported on the client as well. So on an ordinary little laptop, if you stuck one of these things in the laptop, it would pretty much work. And it has a DAX mode file system, a block mode access for raw disk paradigm. It has full application interfaces all the way up the stack. I've talked for years about this, going remote with SMB3. Basically, there are three models here. As you can see, one is the traditional mode we use today with I/O requests that go to a file system. Two would be loads and stores from a buffer cache, which we started to talk about at SDC last year. Our intern, Daniel, did that work. And we are moving to prototype 3, or 2 and 3, in an actual Windows operating system today. These are a little out of order. The enabling technology for mode 3 is this RDMA protocol extension that I've been working hard to advance in the IBTA as well as the IETF. And there are basically two operations that are coming into some form of consensus there. They aren't quite standard yet. The flush is the flush to durability, the way we've been talking. And the second is called an atomic write, or sometimes called a write after flush. And it places a small, a pointer-sized data atomically after the flush is complete. So it's really, really useful for a log writer scenario, where you drop a log record, make it durable, then drop the log pointer. And you can do this without a pipeline bubble, so you can do it at extraordinarily low latency, which is totally impossible today. You can do this with single-digit microseconds of latency instead of double-digit. So currently, we discussed phase one and a little bit of phase two at SDC. Phase two is under investigation for Windows, and Matthew will have a progress report on that coming up in September. Phase three is also possible, and we are honestly working on that too. I just want to say, push mode on the Samba server wouldn't be all that hard. I think it'd be quite convenient. If you have an RDMA connection, and you're able to register one long-lived memory region and hand out the handle with an FS control, the server CPU just sits there and does nothing at that point. It's all client-driven. And it's very easy to do. So I would love to talk to somebody about that.
I'm very interested in implementing that, and I already made some work on RDMA at all.
I'm aware.
I'm just doing this as a spare time project currently, but maybe that will change in future. One question, would it be possible to do push mode also without persistent memory and just do that into the buffer cache?
Yeah, would it be possible to do push mode without persistent memory? Yes, it would. You could do push mode straight into the buffer cache. There might be a little bit of truth in advertising required there, because a lot of clients are going to be coded for durability with a push, right? And if they only get memory residency with a push. But certainly for performance evaluation, for initial coding, et cetera, PMM is not required. In fact, Windows has a mode where you can simulate PMM. You basically define a region of ordinary RAM as PMM. And it actually simulates the expense of the flush. It when you call flush on this thing, it doesn't have to do anything, but it delays for a period of time for you. So that is all. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Tom. Now we have 1 hour and 15 or maybe 30 minutes or something for lunch. Any immediate questions? I think Tom will be around. Just one.
Hi, item. You were talking about POSIX extension and SMB3. I wanted to know if it's like for RFC 2307 has been deprecated in the recent RSAT tools. I wanted to know if it's if UID GID management in Active Directory would become a first class citizen with a POSIX extension, or if it would still be like in the current state, where there is no UID pool, like the RID pool, and if it would become first class citizen.
I'm not. Is this on? It is. Okay. I'm not sure I completely understood the question about the RID pool. You mean defining some RIDs which would be used by the Unix extensions?
In the UID, there is no directory for UID, it's just a placement implemented.
Right.
Without any transactional stuff or whatever. So you can get twice the same UID on two servers. So
yeah. Okay, so that's actually not so much of a protocol question. I think that's more of an interface definition question. I see Steve with his hand up. I don't think that issue would delay the protocol at all.
It would be more like
an Active Directory extension is by no means in scope for the Unix extensions discussion. We intentionally want to keep it separate from such dependencies. If it needs such a dependency, well, we'll figure it out, but that'll throw us back to square one in some regards.
Different topic, completely different topic.
Sorry, I don't know whether I don't see Steve, so I was going to follow up on that. UIDs and GIDs are not in scope for the POSIX extensions. We do not expose, unlike SMB1 POSIX extensions, UIDs and GIDs are not exposed on the wire. We only deal in SIDs.
You could share a table over lunch. Is that a good idea? See you back at 1 p.m. Oh, go to, yeah, right. Okay.